Imagine a country with no army, where classrooms replaced barracks and forests rose where others built factories. A place that turned away from war, embraced peace, and became one of the greenest, most democratic nations on earth. This is the untold story of Costa Rica, how a small republic defied military rule, brokered regional peace, protected half a million species, and redefined what it means to lead without violence. From revolution to rainforest, this is not just a history, it's a blueprint for the future. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Costa Rica, A Journey Through Time, Episode 2. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 5, The Struggle for Independence, Freedom by Default. When nations are born, we imagine thunder. Gunfire, banners lifted high, barricades and proclamations carved in defiance. But Costa Rica came into being not with a roar, but with a rustle, a parchment, a whisper, a pause between wars. It didn't fight for freedom, it inherited it, and then had to decide what to do with it. The year was 1821, and the Spanish Empire was crumbling under the weight of its own history. Across Latin America, revolutions had ignited like brush fires. Venezuela, Colombia, Argentina, Chile, Mexico. These were movements soaked in blood and filled with ideas: liberty, sovereignty, emancipation. They were led by soldiers, intellectuals, and martyrs. Empires do not end gently, and Spain's grip on its colonies loosened only after decades of battles, betrayals, and dreams scribbled in exile. And yet, in Costa Rica, independence came not with gunpowder, but by messenger. On October 13, 1821, word arrived in Cartago, then the capital of Costa Rica. It had traveled down from Guatemala, where on September 15, the Act of Independence of Central America had been declared. This proclamation ended centuries of colonial rule over the provinces of the Captaincy General of Guatemala, which included modern-day Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. But the document that reached Cartago was not a war cry. It was a letter, and with it came an awkward truth. Independence had arrived, but no one in Costa Rica had asked for it. There had been no revolt in the streets, no revolutionaries jailed, no burning effigies of Spanish kings. In fact, most Costa Ricans hadn't even realized they were on the cusp of freedom until it was placed in their hands like an unwrapped gift. What followed was not a celebration, but a quiet, collective holding of breath. What now? Who leads? Are we ready to govern ourselves? Do we even want to? A country unsure of itself. Costa Rica, in 1821, was a small, scattered province, barely 65,000 people in total. There were no standing armies, no central government, no real infrastructure to bind its four main towns: Cartago, San Jose, Heredia, and Alajuela. Each functioned like a micro-republic, with its own loyalties, rivalries, and cultural quirks. Geography kept them apart. Politics would soon pit them against each other. When the independence letter arrived, it sparked not revolution, but debate, long, tense, often bitter. Should Costa Rica remain united with the other Central American provinces in a federal republic? Should it seek annexation to a larger power, such as the newly independent Mexican Empire under Agustín de Iturbide? Or should it chart its own solitary course? There were factions. In Cartago, the old colonial capital and seat of many conservative families loyal to Spain, elites favored joining Mexico. It promised protection, stability, and familiarity. The Mexican Empire still had a monarch, after all, and for many, this offered a sense of continuity. But in San Jose, increasingly a center of liberal thought and trade, the mood was different. Influenced by Enlightenment ideals and fueled by coffee wealth, its leaders argued for republicanism, for self-rule, for a future untethered from kings. Tensions simmered. Each town eyed the others with suspicion. No one wanted to submit to another's will. A civil war loomed, not born of ideology alone, but of regional pride and old wounds. The Acomogo clash, blood in the fog. On April 5, 1823, tensions finally boiled over. At Acamogo, a small hill between Cartago and San Jose, the first and only major battle of Costa Rica's independence period unfolded. It was a brief skirmish by continental standards. About 400 men on each side, mostly farmers, artisans, and young men with little training, clashed with muskets, machetes, and homemade uniforms. It lasted only a few hours. The San Jose and Alajuela forces, representing the Republican cause, defeated the Cartago faction loyal to the Mexican Empire. It wasn't a grand revolution, but it mattered. After Acamogo, Cartago was stripped of its capital status. It was a symbolic gesture, one that announced a shift in power. San Jose, with its Republican vision and growing commercial class, became the new seat of government. The die was cast. Costa Rica would be a sovereign republic, not a province of any empire. But still, the scars lingered. Families were divided. Resentment brewed. Some towns never fully forgave others. It would take decades to truly bind the country together, a newborn republic in a stormy cradle. In the years following independence, Costa Rica, like much of Latin America, entered an age of uncertainty. Its leaders were improvisers, not trained statesmen. Most had never governed before. Constitutions were drafted, revised, discarded, redrafted. The first Costa Rican constitution was ratified in 1825, only to be followed by several more in rapid succession. It was a time of experimentation and improvisation. Citizens, unused to voting or even thinking in political terms, struggled to grasp their role in this new society. Power shifted hands rapidly. Conflicts between liberals and conservatives, mirroring larger trends in Latin America, played out in Costa Rica too, though with less violence. Yet even amidst uncertainty, something remarkable began to happen. Institutions, though fragile, emerged. A national militia was organized. Courts were formed. Schools were founded. And more importantly, there was a genuine, shared will to endure. The people of Costa Rica, raised on hardship and forged in rural simplicity, approached this new era with the same philosophy they had brought to the soil: patience, community, and careful stewardship. Unlike other post-independence nations that descended into chaos or military rule, Costa Rica chose pragmatism over ideology. While coups and strongmen plagued its neighbors, Costa Rica experimented with balance. Leaders were overthrown, yes, but often through procedural means or limited violence. It was a bumpy road, but it wasn't soaked in blood. The power of modesty. It's tempting to view Costa Rica's independence as less dramatic than that of other nations. And in a way, it was. There was no Simon Bolivar, no liberation army sweeping across provinces, no great revolutionary martyr. Instead, there were debates in candlelit town halls, skirmishes between villages, and quiet votes cast by landowners. But this is what made it so uniquely Costa Rican. While others sought glory, Costa Rica sought stability. While others broke themselves chasing visions of grandeur, Costa Rica built slowly, wood beam by wood beam, constitution by constitution. This was not apathy. It was a different kind of courage, the courage to resist chaos, to value peace over spectacle, to imagine a republic built not on conquest, but on compromise. And in that compromise, a national character began to crystallize. It was a character shaped by the agrarian spirit, by years spent tending land no empire wanted. A character that valued education, community, and consensus. A character that did not need thunder to be heard. Costa Rica didn't need to win its independence. It simply had to decide what to do with it. And that choice, that quiet revolution of the mind, would define everything that came next. In the next chapter, we'll follow the young republic as it struggles to find its place in a world still ruled by empires. We'll witness how the coffee bean, now thriving across the Central Valley, becomes not just a crop, but the currency of a new political order, and how the seeds of a powerful elite will be both the country's engine and its challenge. Chapter 6, A Nation Finds Its Feet, Making Something from Nothing. When a child takes its first steps, it stumbles. The footing is unsure, the legs are weak, and the path ahead is unknown. But even in that ungraceful beginning, something beautiful happens. The realization that it can move forward, that it can choose direction. So it was for Costa Rica in the decades following independence. Alone, unsure, and fragile, but walking nonetheless. By the time the ink dried on the early constitutions of the 1820s, Costa Rica had declared itself a republic, on paper at least. In practice, it was something far more complicated, a loose patchwork of towns, farms, and ideologies loosely stitched together by geography, history, and necessity. Independence had come quietly, and so too did the realization that freedom required building, not just defending. And that was where the real struggle began, a country without a center. In the years immediately following the 1823 Ocamogo clash, Costa Rica faced a profound identity crisis. Unlike many of its neighbors, it had no pre-existing military elite, no sprawling bureaucracy, no singular economic engine strong enough to hold the nation together. Instead, there were four towns, Cartago, San Jose, Heredia, and Alajuela, each deeply territorial, each with its own political leanings. San Jose had emerged as the capital by force of arms and the momentum of coffee commerce, but the wounds of civil strife hadn't healed. Cartago, once the colonial capital, still saw itself as the spiritual and political heart of the nation. Heredia and Alajuela wavered between these poles, at times siding with one or the other, at times asserting their own claims. Each town had its own militia, its own church hierarchy, and often its own idea of what Costa Rica should become. There were frequent disputes over taxation, road funding, judicial authority, and even over what kind of republic Costa Rica should be, a centralized one, or a loose federation of city-states. This early rivalry defined much of the 1820s and 1830s. Presidents rose and fell with stunning speed. Some lasted only weeks. Most were local elites, landowners, coffee barons, or educated men with modest legal training. Their authority rarely extended far beyond the capital, and enforcing national policy often required not persuasion, but negotiation or coercion. There was no standing army, no organized police, no system of mass communication. And still, despite the cracks in the foundation, something took root: building a government by hand. In 1825, Costa Rica adopted one of its earliest constitutions, a tentative, idealistic document that outlined the shape of a representative government, defined basic civil rights, and established three branches of state. It was a declaration of aspiration more than capacity. The Legislative Assembly convened in small rooms lit by candlelight, its members often arriving on horseback after days of travel. The executive, limited by both law and logistics, could hardly enforce taxation outside the Central Valley. And the judiciary, though formally established, lacked infrastructure, trained judges, and even proper courtrooms in many parts of the country. But the mere existence of these institutions mattered. They were fragile, yes. Incomplete, yes. But they were also symbolic proof that Costa Rica had chosen law over force, order over chaos. Education as nation-building. One of the earliest, most radical acts of the new republic was to prioritize public education, an uncommon move in a post-colonial world still reeling from the collapse of empires. In 1828, Costa Rica passed laws mandating primary education for both boys and girls, long before many European countries had done the same. It was a bold assertion that the republic would not survive on crops alone, that the new nation required minds as well as hands. In practice, the rollout was uneven. Many rural areas lacked schools, teachers, or even basic supplies. Yet in town after town, parents made sacrifices to send their children to school. Young men and women walked for hours to reach a one-room classroom. Teachers were often barely older than their students, sometimes paid in beans, firewood, or cloth. But they carried the torch of literacy, critical thinking, and citizenship. This growing culture of education slowly began to knit the country together. Newspapers emerged, printed in San Jose and passed hand to hand, read aloud in taverns and coffee stalls. political ideas began to circulate. The word nation stopped being abstract. People began to imagine Costa Rica not just as a location, but as a shared project. The coffee republic begins to stir. While the republic wobbled politically, its economy found surer footing, thanks to the brown bean that had already begun its quiet revolution. Coffee was no longer just a backyard crop. It had become a national enterprise, with exports reaching Europe via the port of Panarinas. Coffee brought money. Money brought roads. Roads brought markets. And markets brought the first hints of social transformation. Coffee also gave rise to a new kind of power, the coffee barons. These were men who owned larger tracts of land, controlled labor flows, and brokered export contracts. Some entered politics. Others stayed behind the curtain, shaping policy through loans and favors. While this elite class was modest by the standards of Mexico or Peru, it represented a shift from egalitarian roots to class dynamics. Tensions brewed between landowners and laborers, between traditional families and upstart merchants. It was the beginning of a new economic order, one that would shape Costa Rican politics for generations. Still, unlike in many other nations, power was rarely enforced at the barrel of a gun. Even the coffee elite operated within a consensus-driven framework. They understood that Costa Rica's strength lay not in domination, but in cohesion, religion, identity, and unity. The Catholic Church remained a powerful presence. Churches weren't just houses of worship. They were community centers, meeting halls, and places of moral and political debate. Priests were often the only literate figures in town, and their influence stretched far beyond the altar. Yet, Costa Rica avoided the religious extremes that destabilized other nations. There was no Inquisition, no clerical dictatorship. Church and state were entwined, but theocratic rule never took hold. Instead, religion acted as a cultural anchor. It helped unify the rural and the urban, the educated and the poor. It provided continuity amidst the uncertainty. And in a young republic full of fragile institutions, continuity was priceless. Crises and fragile progress. The 1830s and 1840s were decades of trial and error. Coups occurred, but were often brief and bloodless. Presidents were deposed, sometimes without a shot fired. Reforms passed, failed, and were retried. The idea of constitutionalism endured, even if the Constitution itself changed repeatedly. And through it all, Costa Rica never fractured completely. Unlike its neighbors, Costa Rica didn't splinter into breakaway republics. It didn't plunge into endless civil war. It bent, but it did not break. Perhaps it was the lack of overwhelming wealth. Perhaps it was the legacy of smallholder equality. Perhaps it was the ingrained habit of consensus over conquest. Whatever the reason, Costa Rica's early nationhood was defined not by its triumphs, but by its persistence. The footsteps of a nation. By the mid-1800s, Costa Rica had begun to feel like a country in truth, not just in law. The capital was established, the courts functioned, the schools educated, and the coffee exported. There was still poverty, still inequality, still unresolved tension between rural and urban regions. But there was also a direction, a shared memory of survival, a belief, tentative but growing, that democracy could work here. Costa Rica had not leapt forward. It had limped, stumbled, crawled. But it had moved. And in that movement, it had learned something profound, that the strength of a nation lies not in how quickly it conquers, but in how patiently it builds. In the next chapter, we will see how this young republic, still finding its voice, steps into a larger stage. The coffee barons will rise. Foreign capital will come knocking. And a new chapter in Costa Rica's story will begin, where wealth will bloom, but so too will the roots of inequality. Chapter 7, Coffee and the Oligarchs, Power Behind the Beans. Every empire has its currency. For Spain, it was gold. For Britain, cotton. For Costa Rica, it was the bean, dark, bitter, aromatic. Coffee didn't just fill cups, it filled coffers. And in its rise, it grew more than fortunes. It grew families into dynasties, towns into cities, and a modest republic into something resembling a nation-state. But every harvest has its shadows, and behind the aroma of roasted wealth, something more complex was brewing. By the mid-19th century, Costa Rica had begun to stabilize politically and economically. The wars of independence were over, and while coups and rivalries still occurred, the country had, uniquely in the region, avoided large-scale conflict. At the center of this fragile peace was a crop that needed no sword to conquer: coffee. The coffee had already been cultivated in Costa Rica for decades by this point, but it wasn't until the 1840s and 1850s that it became the beating heart of the economy. What changed wasn't just the scale of production, but the rise of a new ruling class, men who would transform not only the landscape, but the very structure of the Costa Rican state. They were the coffee barons, the oligarchs of the plantation age. And through them, Costa Rica would begin to prosper, but not without a cost: the rise of the bean. By 1843, the construction of the port of Punta Arenas on the Pacific coast provided a critical outlet for Costa Rica's budding coffee industry. No longer reliant on slow and perilous overland routes to Central America's Caribbean ports, Costa Rican coffee could now be shipped westward and connected to international trade through Chilean intermediaries. This made all the difference. Chile had strong commercial links with Great Britain, and Costa Rican coffee, mild, aromatic, high-altitude Arabica, was precisely what the European market craved. By the 1850s, coffee had surpassed all other exports, accounting for over 90% of national revenue. With profits pouring in, those who owned the land quickly grew in power. Some had started modestly, middle-class farmers who planted coffee trees where maize once grew. But others had the foresight, the capital, and the political connections to expand their holdings. These men were not just planters. They became financiers, exporters, bankers, and eventually politicians. The oligarchy emerges. What makes Costa Rica's coffee elite unique in the Latin American context is that they were not a landed aristocracy imported from Europe. They were largely homegrown, men of mixed backgrounds, often educated, but not noble, ambitious, but not cruel. Yet, as coffee profits grew, so did their appetite for influence. Families like the Montalegres, Jimenezes, and Fernandezes built what would become Costa Rica's first true economic political dynasties. They funded roads and schools, yes, but they also funded candidates, shaped laws, and determined who got access to credit, land, and opportunity. By the 1860s, these oligarchs controlled not just the coffee fields, but the very institutions of state. They sat in the legislative assembly, directed central banks, and advised the president, often from behind the curtain, using soft power and economic leverage more than force. To secure exports, they lobbied for the construction of roads from the highland plantations to coastal ports. To manage international transactions, they pushed for monetary policy reforms. To protect their interests, they influenced laws about land ownership, labor rights, and trade tariffs. Costa Rica was becoming what political scientists call a coffee republic, a state where one crop dominates the economy, and those who control it hold disproportionate sway over governance. Infrastructure, the coffee empire's backbone. The coffee boom demanded infrastructure. Between the 1860s and 1890s, Costa Rica underwent its first major modernization campaign, funded largely by coffee taxes, oligarch investments, and foreign loans. Bridges were built over rivers that once cut towns off for weeks during the rainy season. Wagon roads, muddy and dangerous in earlier decades, were replaced by improved stone routes. The cart driver, or boyero, became a national symbol, guiding ox-drawn carts filled with sacks of beans from inland farms to Punta Arenas and eventually to global markets. Schools were built with coffee money. The Teatro Nacional, constructed in the 1890s, was financed in part by a tax on coffee exports. With its marble staircases, crystal chandeliers, and frescoed ceilings, it stood not only as a cultural beacon, but as a monument to the wealth that coffee had brought to a small, once-forgotten republic. And yet, this infrastructure mostly served the export economy. Roads were not built to connect people, but to move beans. Ports were not designed for migration, but for profit. What was good for coffee was good for Costa Rica, but only if you were close enough to the coffee economy to benefit. The price of prosperity. Not everyone was invited to the banquet. The coffee elite grew rich, but their workers remained land poor and dependent. Smallholders were increasingly edged out by larger estates. Land that had once been community-owned or inherited through generations was sold under pressure, sometimes from debt, sometimes from sheer economic necessity. Laborers, especially in the Central Valley and outlying regions, became seasonal migrants, moving from estate to estate during harvest time, often earning just enough to survive. Indigenous groups and Afro-descendant communities, already marginalized by geography and colonial legacy, found themselves even further excluded from this new economic order. There were no violent uprisings. Costa Rica's culture of moderation held firm, but there was resentment, quiet, persistent, like a tremor before a quake. In rural areas, social stratification deepened. Education, increasingly touted as a pillar of the republic, became less accessible to the children of coffee pickers. Political participation, while technically open, remained the realm of literate, property-owning men, many of whom were tied to coffee wealth in one way or another. And yet, despite these imbalances, the oligarchs were seen by many as nation builders. They weren't distant landlords. They lived in the same cities. Their children attended the same schools. They invested in national projects. They maintained a paternalistic relationship with their workers, charitable, at times sincere, but always hierarchical. This dynamic preserved stability, but also sowed the seeds of a future reckoning. Coffee and national identity. By the late 19th century, coffee was not just an export. It was an identity. It shaped how Costa Ricans saw themselves. Hardworking, rural, modest, productive. The coffee farmer, humble but dignified, became the symbolic citizen. Government propaganda often featured families harvesting beans under the sun, surrounded by greenery, smiling. The narrative was clear. Costa Rica was a country where democracy and development walked hand in hand, guided by the spirit of the Cafetalero. And to an extent, it was true. Compared to its neighbors, Costa Rica was peaceful. Education was widespread. Democratic institutions existed and functioned. A middle class was growing. But beneath the surface, the concentration of wealth and political power in the hands of a few families posed risks that the Republic had not yet fully acknowledged. The tensions yet to come. As the 20th century approached, new challenges loomed. Global coffee prices began to fluctuate. Foreign capital, especially from the United States, started to knock at the door, promising investment but demanding control. And among the working poor, a new class of teachers, students, and thinkers began to question the oligarchic structure of society. They asked, can a republic truly be free if most of its land is held by a few? What good is education if laborers still toil in debt? How long can peace last if prosperity is not shared? These were questions the oligarchs could not ignore forever. In the next chapter, we will follow the dramatic entry of Minor Keith, the United States, and the construction of the Atlantic Railroad, a project that would connect the nation from coast to coast, but also tether it to foreign powers. We'll explore how bananas, not coffee, became the next empire, and how Costa Rica's sovereignty would be tested not by bullets, but by contracts. Chapter 8, A Railroad, A Revolution, Minor Keith and the Banana Empire. It began with steel and sweat, with tracks driven into the heart of the jungle, with dynamite in the cliffs and mosquito-bitten men dying by the thousands. A railroad was promised, a lifeline to connect Costa Rica's inland riches to the Atlantic world. But when the last spike was hammered and the final train roared toward the sea, it wasn't just coffee that rode those rails. It was power. It was empire. And the tracks did not run both ways. By the 1870s, Costa Rica stood at a crossroads. The coffee economy, anchored in the Central Valley, had matured into the backbone of the republic. Exports were growing. San Jose was modernizing. Literacy was climbing. But there was a problem, a logistical one, that threatened to stall national progress. all of Costa Rica's coffee exports were shipped from Punarenas on the Pacific coast, requiring a slow, grueling wagon haul through the mountains. Meanwhile, the Atlantic coast, closer to European markets, remained largely disconnected, underdeveloped, and cloaked in thick jungle. The need for an interoceanic railway had been debated for years, but now it became urgent. The government wanted a railroad. The coffee barons needed it. But Costa Rica didn't have the resources or the expertise to build it alone. So it turned to foreign capital. Enter Minor Cooper Keith. Into this gap stepped Minor Cooper Keith, a Texan businessman, railroad contractor, and eventual architect of one of the most powerful corporate empires in Central American history. Keith had first arrived in Costa Rica in the early 1870s, accompanying his uncle Henry Meigs, a well-known railroad entrepreneur with projects across South America. When Meigs died in 1877, Keith took over the Costa Rican Railroad contract, young, ambitious, and largely untested. What he found was a landscape both promising and punishing. The railroad was supposed to run from San Jose to Limon, slicing through Costa Rica's central mountains, descending through the Caribbean lowlands, and finally arriving at the Atlantic Ocean. On a map, it looked simple. On the ground, it was hell. Workers labored through swamp and rainforest, through landslides and disease. Entire work crews were swallowed by malaria, yellow fever, and dysentery. At least 4,000 laborers died. Some estimates say up to 5,000, mostly Jamaicans, Chinese, and Italian immigrants brought in under indentured contracts. These men toiled in heat and mud, often buried in unmarked graves beside the very tracks they helped build. And yet, Keith pressed on. With logistical genius and ruthless determination, he pushed the line eastward, mile by agonizing mile. When Costa Rica ran out of money to fund the project, Keith loaned the government $1.2 million, an astronomical sum for the time. In return, he was given land, 800,000 acres, along the railway, and 99-year tax exemptions to develop it as he saw fit. With that stroke of the pen, Costa Rica had entered into a new kind of dependency, one not based on conquest, but on concession. The Banana Empire is born. As the railroad neared completion, Keith faced another challenge: how to make the line profitable year-round, not just during the coffee harvest. The answer came in the form of a curved yellow fruit, relatively unknown to the Western world, but abundant in the tropical lowlands, bananas. Keith began planting bananas along the railway to feed his laborers, but soon realized their commercial potential. The fruit was hardy, cheap to grow, and, most importantly, delicious to the European and American palate. With refrigeration technology improving, bananas could now survive the voyage to New Orleans and beyond. By the 1880s, Keith had begun shipping bananas directly to the United States. Demand exploded. What followed was a transformation of the Atlantic lowlands. Once a neglected region of marshland and mosquito clouds, it became the epicenter of a booming banana industry. Keith brought in thousands of Afro-Caribbean laborers, primarily from Jamaica, who spoke English, practiced Protestant Christianity, and formed vibrant, self-sustaining communities, particularly around Limon. These workers were segregated linguistically, culturally, racially, from the rest of Costa Rican society. Most were denied citizenship. They were excluded from land ownership. But without them, the banana boom could not have happened. Keith's success didn't stop at the border. In 1899, he merged his operations with several others to form the United Fruit Company, UFCO, one of the most powerful multinational corporations of its time. Based in Boston, UFCO quickly expanded into Honduras, Guatemala, Panama, and Colombia. But Costa Rica remained its crown jewel. Through UFCO, Keith's banana empire took on a life of its own. The company controlled not just plantations, but railroads, telegraph lines, shipping ports, and even municipal governments in the Atlantic region. In some areas, UFCO was the state. The cost of development, to many in the capital, the banana boom seemed like a godsend. It brought infrastructure, jobs, and foreign investment. Costa Rica's GDP soared. Limon became a bustling port. Foreign journalists hailed the country as a model of development and civilized tropical enterprise. But to others, the cost was steep. The Atlantic coast became a company colony, run not by elected officials, but by managers. Local workers faced low wages, harsh conditions, and no legal protections. Strikes were rare and often crushed. Indigenous lands were taken. Forests were cleared. Rivers were diverted. Workers were paid in company scrip, redeemable only at company stores. And then there was the question of sovereignty. United Fruit wielded enormous influence over Costa Rican politics. Presidents courted the company. Laws were written with its approval. Tax breaks were extended. Censorship and suppression were sometimes used to protect corporate interests. While Costa Rica had no army to enforce oppression, economic power became its own form of control. Critics warned of a banana republic, a term that, though coined elsewhere, increasingly felt relevant. Could a sovereign nation truly govern itself if one foreign company controlled its ports, its trains, and its jobs? The debate reached the heart of Costa Rican identity. Was the country a democracy or a subcontractor to American capital? The railroad's legacy. The Atlantic Railroad, completed in 1890, had achieved its original purpose. It connected the Central Valley to the Caribbean. It had expanded trade, fueled economic growth, and helped modernize the nation. But it also divided the country, not just geographically, but socially and racially. The people of the Central Valley, largely mestizo, Catholic, Spanish-speaking, benefited the most. Those along the Atlantic coast, largely black, English-speaking, Protestant, remained marginalized, often denied the full rights of citizenship well into the 20th century. The railroad was a symbol of both progress and exploitation. It was a line of steel and of tension. Minor Keith, visionary or usurper? Even today, the legacy of Minor Cooper Keith remains complex. To some, he is a visionary entrepreneur, a man who helped modernize Costa Rica, connect it to global markets, and create industries that lifted thousands out of poverty. Without his investment, the railroad might never have been built. To others, he is a colonizer in a business suit who used Costa Rica's desperation to gain land, immunity, and influence far beyond what any citizen could achieve. The truth lies somewhere in between. Keith was both builder and broker, benefactor and beneficiary, a man whose ambition reshaped a nation, but left deep questions in his wake. Questions about power, ownership, labor, and justice. A nation at a crossroads. By the dawn of the 20th century, Costa Rica stood taller than ever. Economically vibrant, politically stable, internationally respected. But the seeds of future tensions had already been sown. The banana empire would not be easily uprooted. The Atlantic region would not easily be integrated. And Costa Rica's ideals of democracy, equality, and sovereignty would be tested again and again by the invisible hands of capital and control. In the next chapter, we'll turn to those unseen tensions as workers begin to rise, as reformers step forward, and as Costa Rica begins to question the price of its peace. We'll enter the age of labor movements, class consciousness, and the slow, grinding path toward a more inclusive nation.